Welcome to the Filibuster, the podcast of the Union University Political Science Department. The Senate filibuster is the right to unlimited debate. This means that senators could speak nonstop on the floor with the hope of changing their fellow senators' minds and/or reaching and persuading a broader audience. Because of this, some have called the Senate the world's greatest deliberative body. Now, unlike the Senate filibuster, we're going to place a limit on our discussion, though we still hope to be a forum of civil debate and discussion of major issues from our academic, political, and Christian perspectives. The topic of our podcast today is the emerging Trump foreign policy. I'm Sean Evans. I'm the department chair, and I'll be today's podcast host. I'm joined today by Seth Brake, our international relations professor. So the tables are turned a bit here. You have been interviewing me because we've been talking about the elections most of the year. But now,
now we get to talk about something interesting.
To be the star. Oh, ouch. Wow. Wow. How about this? Okay. So let's start off with one of your posts on election day. You claim that whoever wins the election will be a loser in the history books because of the challenges that they will face. What did you mean by this?
Well, at the time, I was thinking about the... Well, I mean, I like all Americans, I was considering my options, right?
Yeah.
But the challenges that the winner at the time, the way I saw it, was going to face was a time when, obviously, there's an ongoing challenge to the U.S.-led system of the world going on in Eastern Europe with the Ukraine-Russia war, where Russia has invaded Ukraine, huge challenge to international norms, a huge puzzle for U.S. foreign policy, and I didn't think Biden was handling it very well, but when I looked at the two options, I wasn't sure they were going to be able to navigate that as well either. And then you pivot over to the Middle East, and we have this massive conflict raging that at the time, I mean, Israel is really struggling to drive Hamas out of Gaza. And Iran was pouring support into Israel's adversaries there as well. Now Israel had opened up a front in Lebanon against Hezbollah, and you know that was just continuing to escalate. And so I thought that was going to be something that dominated the attention of whoever won. But you know, navigating that's complicated. And then finally, and of course, many people that we're going to be talking about later might consider to be the most important, is the challenge posed by China, which is not a ongoing violent challenge at the moment, but certainly threatens to be. And if you look at the pressures facing Chinese leadership domestically, but also just timing, it really seems like the next 4 years are probably when they're going to have to make their challenge as well. And so assuming that you're walking into a scenario where, in a best case scenario, we would struggle to handle one of these challenges, we're expecting three, or we're looking down the barrel of three, I'm not sure that any of them have the resources or the experience to handle that. So I was skeptical that this was a election you even want to win necessarily. Right now, obviously, you always want to win.
Sure.
You want to give it your best shot. But I didn't see this. I didn't see either candidate as walking into an enviable situation. But the interesting thing now is we know who won. Right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, and we won. We knew on election night, or maybe the morning after.
It depends when you went to bed
at 2 a.m. or so. But yes, and we're not having the challenges that we had even 4 or 8 years ago.
Which is a huge thing.
I mean, the things we take for granted.
Yes, absolutely. And it gives the winner here a much better position for these issues too, walking in with this kind of confidence as well.
Okay, let's talk about the three issues that you have raised and what you think Trump will try to do.
Well,
okay.
Well, can I add something though?
You may.
Because the situation has changed significantly since I made that post.
Yeah.
And
we'll talk about
that. Okay, yeah. Well, go ahead then. Right.
Let's start by looking at what's going on in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
So before the election, Trump said that he will end the war before he is elected within 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
He's now said he thinks it's going to take a little bit longer than 24 hours. What's changed?
Well, I mean, Trump's statements about timelines and things like that, they're always given in that Trump fashion. I'm not sure that part has changed necessarily, but what's changed in Ukraine itself is that Russia has changed. Russia has just very recently lost their major Middle Eastern ally. Assad has been driven out of power in Syria. And it's funny that it's the Russia-Ukraine conflict that I think the fall of the Assad regime affects the most, not the Israel-Gaza conflict. But I think that this is significant. It's a loss of Russian ability to project into Africa. It's a loss of Russian, potentially could be a loss of Russian access to the Mediterranean, depending on what happens in that base.
Yeah, well, and what you're talking about is that ever since Assad has fallen, one of the things I've heard a lot of people say is Russia's not as strong as we thought they were.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, and we knew that Russia had to focus on Ukraine and that they were drawing lots of resources and attention from there, but I don't think we had seen as dramatic evidence of that as we have now with the fall of the Assad regime. Their protector is gone. And that means that Russia is they're stretched thin. It means that they're more desperate than maybe they were letting on. And then the other element that we have working into this is now the very active involvement of all those North Korean soldiers.
Okay, I was about to ask that. I mean, the fact that he's having to get 10,000 North Korean soldiers to fight. Instead of getting more Russians to fight seems to me an indication that he realizes that there's limits to what he can do without sparking a backlash within his own country.
Well, and up until the last week, they were only being used defensively, but now they're being sent on attacks. So that tells us, I think, a lot about the position they're in. The other thing that has, and this had already changed by the time I made the post, but the other thing that we need to understand that is shifting there is that Biden has released some of the limitations on Ukrainian use of American missiles in that they're now allowed to strike deep into Russian territory, which has also shifted things dramatically. And I think what we're looking at is, at least with the Russia side of this, Donald Trump is walking into a actually fairly strong negotiating position.
Well, and you mentioned about Ukraine striking with missiles, but they also assassinated Russian general.
That's right, just yesterday.
Which seems to be a brazen attack.
Well, now's the time for brazen attacks, right?
Right. Well, but the other thing we've been seeing, though, is Russians have been gaining on the battlefield.
Yeah, no, they have, yes.
Which would kind of indicate that Ukraine is in a difficult position.
Well, so anytime that there, and this is something that has been studied with this, when there's a leadership change in an important negotiating partner, both sides have to figure out what kind of a world they live in now. And what that means is that both are going to be assessing each other's strength. So at this point in the conflict, both Ukraine and Russia need to demonstrate to each other their strength and resolve. And I think that's what we see happening right now. We see Ukraine trying to demonstrate their ability to strike in two different ways deep inside Russia, with missiles that the U.S. now allows them to use, and with, you know, you can just put bombs in front of people's houses, right? So they're trying to demonstrate their ability to strike there. And then Russia is trying to demonstrate, no, we are still a battlefield presence. We're doing these big attacks. We can absorb casualties, very high amounts of casualties, in exchange for land, and it doesn't really affect us.
Well,
right?
And we also have to remember that Ukraine actually invaded Russia.
That's right. That's right.
And over still, the summer, yeah, and they still
that's
hold
right.
portions.
A small amount they still hold, yes.
In Kursk.
Which is where the North Koreans are being used as well.
Okay, so here's my question. Is there a deal to be had, and what is it, and how do we get there?
Well, you know, there's always a deal. The question is, can you see it, right? The question is, can both sides agree about where the deal is? And I think this is a situation where we have it's the old idea of the apocalypse or unveiling, when there's hidden information and you're trying to guess about it the whole time, and then suddenly it's there in front of you. And we've seen some of the curtain pulled back now on both sides. We have more information about the capabilities of both sides. And what we know is that if Trump is a savvy negotiator, there probably is a deal right now that can be detected. The question is Trump capable of doing that? And here's my positive and then my negative outlook on this.
Okay.
Positive outlook is that Trump has always built himself as someone who is good at negotiating from a position of strength. We've given him that situation. We have put all the cards on the table that are exactly what Trump holds his own specialty to be when it comes to this sort of thing. So if Trump is capable of doing anything, it should be this. Now, the flip side is that Trump seems to be focused on a lot of the wrong things right now. He is... And these are valid concerns, right? But they're not concerns that directly affect this. You know, he wants Europe to stand on its own militarily. That's good. I mean, that's something that I think Trump should be focusing on. But does that affect this conflict right now? I don't know. And then if you look at Trump's, and we'll talk about Trump's nominees later, but he's nominating many Russia hawks to, not Russia hawks, China hawks to positions, people who want to focus more on China. This means the pressure to get the deal done now will be a lot stronger. And if you can't credibly walk away from the negotiating table, that actually gives you a weakness. So having a lot of people in positions who basically depend, or their entire foreign policy strategy depends on Trump getting a deal right now, that weakens his position a little bit.
Okay, see, I kind of question Trump's deal-making strategy for this. He talks a big game, somebody comes, offers him something, and he claims it as a win, but there's not really follow-through. The perfect thing was, hey, I'll put these tariffs on China. Xi said, hey, we'll buy all this American goods, and he never did it.
Yeah.
Or just like the promises of 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico, and now they're saying, hey, we'll do something about the border. So it's more about it, a ploy to get something, but he's not really getting what he needs, but he does get something.
Well, if he knows what he needs, and if he has good team supplying him with that information, and he's able to put that together, then I still think that this is the best case scenario for him. I just don't know, you know, if he actually does have those strengths. Like that's the thing.
Oh, okay. So I know he's got leverage over Ukraine in terms of continuing to fund them. What leverage does he have over Russia to try to get them to make a good deal for both sides?
Russia's foreign policy is falling apart across the board. I mean, this is what the Assad regime's fall changes in this discussion. Russia is losing their, when they lose Syria, they might lose Africa. Right, that's their connection there. Their access to Mediterranean shipping, their naval assets there, things like that. Like Russia is in a situation where they're looking at the possibility of their global influence declining dramatically right now. So that's what Trump has over them. They're in a tailspin in terms of influence. So if Russia can freeze things right now, they can control the losses.
Well, then wouldn't this be an incentive for the U.S. to try to put the heel on Russia a little bit more?
That's what you have to do to
get
the deal. Yeah, you have to. Well, and you have to demonstrate that you're capable of that, right? And then and then it's possible that both sides could properly estimate each other's resolve and power. That's the situation that could be unfolding. But I think what you're hinting at there is also the dark side of these negotiations. And looking at the comments made by the people Trump is putting in positions, I'm not sure this is a concern right now. But there is certainly a way to think about this where the longer this war goes on, the better it is for the United States in a certain way, because Russia is being degraded. They're losing people and equipment.
Right, and the big concern is you don't make a deal just to make a deal. You need to have a deal to where Trump isn't seen as making a bad deal in the end.
Well, and Putin has those same constraints. He needs to walk away with a deal that he can say, I got the best we could get. And then, of course, there's a strange element here where we're talking as if the main negotiating partners are the United States and Russia, but that's not really the case.
The
main negotiating partners are Ukraine and Russia, or the leadership in both countries, which complicates things a little bit. But I don't actually think that Ukraine's incentives are that much different than the United States right now. And so, you know, the simplification kind of works, but I didn't want to leave that part of the discussion out because they are the ones who are going to be the main negotiating partner.
And even if they give up land, they want certain security guarantees, and they're not going to want those from Russia.
Right. Well,
they're going to want it from NATO.
That's right.
And that, I think, is a big lift for Trump to get the U.S. to accept,
and
especially with everything he's been saying for the past 4 years.
If Trump really wants the best negotiating position there, Putin needs to think that Ukrainian NATO membership is on the table, so that then Trump can remove it from the table as a negotiating tactic. Like that would be the ideal situation. So I expect to see people beginning to talk again about Ukrainian NATO membership in the next few months if they know what they're doing.
Okay, let's switch to topic number two. I mean, what Trump has said, he actually thinks the Middle East is easier to solve than Ukraine now. Since when was the Middle East easier to solve than anything else around
the globe? Now, when did he make that comment?
The past week or so.
Okay.
I think. Yeah. It might.
I think he's right.
Been in his press conference.
Yeah.
Yesterday. All right. So the Middle East can be solved. All
well,
right.
No, it's,
tell
it's,
us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, solved is a complicated
here.
Word, right?
Oh,
but
okay,
we got to look at this from
yes.
U.S. Strategic interest, and what the United States needs is credible, reliable allies in the Middle East, and we are in a situation where I don't think the complete defeat of Israel is on the table anymore. It was earlier in this conflict. It is not currently.
Well, right. I mean, yeah. I think one of the things that we can say is Israel was concerned that their aura of deterrence mm-hmm. had faltered. I think that aura of deterrence is back.
Oh, it is back, and it has been demonstrated dramatically in that Iran is out of the fight. We had that exchange of missiles and bombers between Israel and Iran, and Israel seemed to have actually dramatically harmed Iran's ability to either produce or use missiles. There's different, you know, the different interpretations of what happened there. But whatever it is, they seem to be relatively toothless right now. And then, right after that, Israel defeated Hezbollah. What they have negotiated themselves to is a ceasefire now, but it was on Israel's terms. Israel just won. And they have not been able to do the same thing to Hamas, but Hezbollah is currently out of the equation. That's probably a big part of the fall of Assad as well.
Well, right.
Yeah.
I mean, and as I said, the fall of Assad's an even bigger thing for Hezbollah because mm-hmm. they get all their supplies through Syria.
That's right. That's right.
With that. And so with the attacks on the mm-hmm. communication systems
right.
And other things, their concern about resupply is real,
right.
which hopefully is an opportunity for other Lebanese factions
yes.
to try to counter Hezbollah's influence, because they've been exercising a veto over everything going on within Lebanon.
Now, the interesting thing about this is that we don't know what Syria is going to end up looking like, right? Like there's a right. chance that Syria becomes a Turkish proxy, right? That's something that could happen. There's a chance that Syria could break out into another major conflict. I mean, the group that has taken over the majority of the country now, and then the Kurdish-backed SDF group, they're at odds. They're fighting each other right now. If that breaks out into a wider conflict, you know, that could become chaotic again. I think, you know, we see some acknowledgement of that in the way that Israel is currently and continues to do these massive bombing campaigns mm-hmm. against the stockpiles of Syrian army equipment. They just seem to be systematically deleting whatever remains of the Syrian armed forces,
right.
military,
and
navy.
And the other thing to remember is that there's still ISIS groups controlling
oh, yes.
territory within
right.
Syria.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and then you mentioned the Turks. They actually control a portion
that's right.
of Syria in the northwest.
Along the border, yeah.
Yeah,
well,
along
the border. And there are some of the groups fighting that are complete proxies of Turkey, and there are some that are just supplied by Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so we just don't know how this is going to shake up. If it ends up being completely Turkey-dominated, that's actually fairly bad news for Israel. But the interesting thing is that it's not good news for Iran. It's just a new player. That changes that balance. So that's, in terms of U.S. strategic interests, that's kind of a wash. It is bad news for both of our most reliable allies in the Levant, though, which would be the Kurdish groups and Israel.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Hamas here.
Yeah.
Just for the simple fact of you said they haven't been able to defeat them.
That's right.
Okay. Isn't defeat the wrong word here?
Well, defeat is a word that is empty and you can fill with whatever you need, right? But whatever you would fill it with, they don't have it. And I think that's the important thing. There are still hostages that are held. There is still some kind of command structure, and they are still able to operate and conduct combat, right? So all the things that, you know, at least one of those things Israel would have had to have taken from them to call this some kind of victory, and they haven't.
Yeah. So, I mean, my big concern with what Israel has been doing with this is they don't have a day after plan. I mean,
yeah.
and so this is kind of the Bush-Iraq syndrome
sure.
in that they won, but they didn't know what to do when they got it. It seems to me that Israel doesn't know what to do when and if they are able to defeat Hamas, however we're going to define that. In which case, both with Hezbollah and Hamas, the way I look at this is, okay, they're won victories for now, But are they just setting the stage for the same trouble occurring again and again and again?
But there have been unambiguous victories in other places there, right? Like the Israel's attack against Hezbollah was an unambiguous victory.
And, absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
And that's the thing that they have not achieved in Gaza. And I think that, that's more what's dragging that down. But, and this is where I think that maybe Trump has a point on this one, is that Israel's in a good position now, even with the fact that they're not winning there. I mean, when we're talking in terms of U.S. strategic interests, you know, there are places where Israel could win too much in Gaza, right? You don't want the allegations of ethnic cleansing to become true,
right?
And that's that, you know, that's probably not going to happen at this point. The ways that could break down from a U.S., you know, strictly, again, I'm taking this from a U.S. strategic interest perspective here, the situation is shaping up really nicely for the U.S. here, because Iran has lost all of its hooks. It's lost all, except, you know, the Houthis in Yemen. That's what they've got left.
Right.
I mean, if that's what you're pinning your foreign policy on, you're in big trouble, right? And so now, when Trump can come back into office,
And the thing I'd also say is, everyone realizes the Ayatollah Khomeini is old and is not going to be around much longer.
Right.
It's also the transition of who takes his place, and the people who are being thrown out is no one thinks these people will have the same kind of influence that he has.
Well, and the future of the Islamic Republic is complicated now, because they've lost all their foreign policy projects, basically. And their ability to go toe-to-toe with Israel seems to have been lost as well. Now, again, they still have their access to all the groups in Iraq, and we've talked about the Houthis. Like, Iran is not in danger of being invaded or collapsed
right.
But they can't project their power anymore. They can't affect these outcomes like they could before. And so when Trump says this is easy to resolve, I think what he means is he's going to do what he did last time and start trying to normalize relationships between Israel and further Arab states.
Right. So,
and that's something that could happen now.
And the one that everyone's talked about is Saudi Arabia, surprisingly enough, people said after the Hamas attack, that made it even less likely that normalization would occur.
Well, and it did. I mean, and that made it harder.
And now we're thinking it's back on track.
I mean, it's back on track because Israel's winning. That's just what it is. And there are cold realities of power that are going to win in these scenarios. And it might take some time, it might take some negotiation, but if Trump's looking for an easy win, this is the only place you can find it. And so I think that's why he says that. Because, you know, if you negotiate a peace in Ukraine, you're still looking at a Russia that got away with something. You're still looking at a Russia that, though, you know, smarting, licking its wounds, trying to rebuild things, still has foreign policy goals that it's trying to acquire. Now, of course, with the Syria thing, maybe we need to reassess some of that. But regardless, it's still a situation where, you know, that's hard to find a silver lining in. But in the Levant, in the, you know, or the wider Middle East, it's a situation where there probably is a outcome on the table that is good for the United States that Trump thinks he might be able to get.
Okay, so let's turn to the last major challenge, and probably, I guess what most people would say is the biggest challenge that we face.
And it's the one that hasn't started yet, right?
Hasn't started yet. So, I mean, we're still have people being concerned about the Thucydides trap, about a rise in, to where a rise in power is attacked by the declining power, i.e. the U.S. in this case, which leads to war, though it looks like the war we're looking at would not be a shooting war, it would be a trade war.
So the funny thing about the Thucydides trap is that we expect it's the declining power that starts it, right? In this situation, who's the declining power? This is the complicated question, right?
Okay. Now that's something that I don't think we talk that much about, because my view is Xi's absolute power is backfiring on him, because he's basically surrounded by people who are telling him he's great. Mm-hmm. They're not challenging him, and they're just making some significant mistakes.
Which is an old problem for personalist autocrats.
Yeah, it
always happens. And
we saw that with Mao, which is why they went to the 2-term limit the alternations in power.
Went to a strong single-party authoritarian system, which is historically the most effective and stable of the authoritarian systems. But the the thing we're used to the rising power being the one with all the time on its hands, mm-hmm. and the declining power is the one on a ticking clock. But China is very much on a ticking clock here. They're obviously, we've been looking at their economic and demographic problems for decades, and those have not gotten better. But also the legitimacy of Xi's government, in a way, depends on some foreign policy outcomes that he just can't deliver at this point. Like, for example, Taiwan is the big one that mm-hmm. everyone's watching. And in the last few years, they've gotten increasingly aggressive towards Taiwan. It does seem like they can credibly threaten to do something in some way. And I say do something in some way because there's a lot of options for them on the table. Right. But they're all, none of them are good for Taiwan.
Right. So the what I've always heard is 2028 is the year.
Well, I mean, you don't want to put a, you know, you don't want to put a calendar, put it on
sure,
the calendar.
Right.
But yeah, that it's, they've been building up their capability, building up landing craft, things like that. But the time's approaching, I guess, is the point. And it's not, it's the party on the ticking clock that's unpredictable. But the United States is also in some ways a declining power.
Yeah.
And so when you have two parties who could, you can make the case for them being declining powers. I don't know if the Thucydides trap's the right model anymore, but it's not good. I mean, it, what we've added is a lot of uncertainty and unpredictability on both parties. If you look at the way that the actually, the Biden administration and the Trump administration talk about China, it's in terms of a expected adversary. We like to use the old IR term of a rivalry between parties
yeah.
that have, you know, regular and consistent disagreements on core strategic interests, right? But this is a little bit worse than a rivalry in that it is a rivalry that everyone expects to intensify. And so, you know, there's the self-fulfilling prophecy aspect of that, but there's also just, again, the logic of the situation both countries are in that makes things, the nice thing about stable rivalries is that they can predict each other, and
right.
that can actually be a really controlled effect. Like the U.S. and the Soviet Union during many parts of the Cold War were, they knew each other's actions, you know, like the whole idea of Kremlinology, right? If you know what's going on in the Soviet Union and the Soviet Union knows what's going on in the United States, they can, even though they disagree vehemently about everything, they can manage that disagreement. But what do you do when it's hard for China and the United States to predict each other because they're both in a situation where they feel like time is slipping away from them? And that's just a lot less predictable. So I guess the point here is that it's the conflict that we're not fighting that looks scariest in some ways. And so how does the Trump administration manage that? Because there's a world where you pull back too much, where you're too cautious, and
right.
you let China get that critical mass, right? And then you are maybe in a Thucydides trap situation, and some things look inevitable that maybe looked optional right now. Or the other thing is that maybe you jump the gun. Maybe you accidentally put yourself in a situation where you're initiating conflict that was unnecessary. And there's no, it's not easy to plot the course between those two things, and they both lead to a dramatically violent and bad outcome for both countries.
Yeah, and that's something I think we all want to avoid. So, do you think that we can avoid a military conflict with China?
Yes.
China then. It's Taiwan, the South China Sea,
yes.
other things. Okay.
It can be avoided.
It can be, okay.
That's right.
Will it?
Well, I mean, this is a question for Donald Trump and the people that he's tapping to take these roles, you know, depending who gets in and who doesn't. But what he would have to do to avoid it is be very unambiguous toward China. I think it's probably time to end the strategic ambiguity that we have on some of these issues. China and the United States need to know what each other's core strategic interests are. They need to clearly communicate them and signal in, you know, costly, clear ways what those interests are so that they can negotiate this between each other.
Well, if you go back to when Biden mm-hmm. and Xi met, what is it, a month ago, China was clear about what its red lines were, and one of those red lines was Taiwan.
Well, see, red lines are complicated because
Well, I mean, that
yeah.
that was his way of saying, here's our core interest we're not going to compromise on.
But that's cheap talk. I mean, we don't believe them and they don't believe us. That's the problem. It gets even worse when both sides know that each other has an incentive to bluff about their red lines, right? So now you have an incentive to call bluffs you know, a world where both sides have an incentive to call bluffs, but some of those are real, is the most dangerous one out there.
That's
right?
What the problem is. Yeah. Well, I would think with Trump's promise of tariffs of 60% on Chinese goods.
That's his strategy.
Whether that happens or not, I don't know.
Well,
but
hopefully it doesn't,
but
right?
The it's idea, coercion. It's coercion, and it's also has a great chance of backfiring on the U.S. economy.
Well, that's the whole point of this kind of trade war, is that you think that you can absorb costs better than they can. It will backfire. The point is that it backfires. That's what makes it a good tool. It's a costly signal. It's saying we are willing to absorb pain in order to harm you.
But the question is, how long will the U.S. Take the pain? Because...
Well, not just the U.S.
But my view is an authoritarian regime can push back on its people a lot more than a democratic regime will.
That's complicated
and
in the research.
Part of it also, I'd say, is what Donald Trump pays more attention to than public approval is economic performance.
Right.
The Dow Jones. And so he wants to be tough on trade, but he doesn't want it to really affect the economy in a negative way.
The important thing I would add to that is, to each of those statements, we need there's a missing comparative term. So it's Donald Trump cares about the economy. Yes, he does. Does he care about it more than Xi Jinping? Donald Trump will create costs for the American people. Does that harm him more than creating costs for Chinese businesses does to Xi, right? That's the real question. It's that comparative element that determines whether or not that's an effective threat. Because I think we keep calling these tariffs because Trump calls them tariffs, but if I'm looking at the different terms that we have in international relations and foreign policy, these things are sanctions.
Yeah.
They're targeted withdrawals of economic activity to induce or coerce. And so he's threatening these things to change behavior. The model we need to be looking at is sanctions, and if we're looking at sanctions, then we're back to the bargaining theory. We're back to costly actions and incurring costs and making those threats. So the question is, who is most affected? Who has the most ability to harm their own people to get a foreign policy outcome? And is it Xi Jinping or Donald Trump? And the complicating thing here is that, yes, the democracy has to be more receptive to the opinion of the people. So you'd think that would give them more flexibility. But the other side of it is that we know that autocrats have much more incentive to back down, because what the autocrat doesn't, what the autocrat is not held to account for not following through. And so if Donald Trump says, I'm going to be tough on China, and then he caves to China within 3 months of imposing the sanctions, that looks really bad for him. That could hurt his electoral outcomes. Xi Jinping does not have that kind of a check on him. He can back down with almost no consequences on some issues, not on Taiwan, interestingly,
right,
but on some issues he can. And so it's actually not clear that democracies are more vulnerable to that kind of threat, because autocracies are more likely to give in. So that's the complicating element there that makes it a little hard to predict who's better at using economic coercion.
Oh, okay. So we're running low on time.
Oh, sure,
I think we're going to turn this into a two-part episode here. But before we leave, let's talk real briefly as Christians.
Yes.
How should we be viewing these challenges, and how we should approach this?
Yeah. So, and this is where we kind of, when we were talking about the different U.S. approaches to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, I do think that as Christians, we should be very reluctant to adopt frameworks like we want to increase the suffering and death in this war for foreign policy outcomes. I do think that the amount of destruction and death that is being caused by this conflict is the type of thing where there's a point where we want it to end more than we want Russia to be bled. That's the first thing that comes to mind. But this is the case in all these conflicts, right? I mean, how can we be so blasé about the amount of destruction that any of these conflicts will cause when we have this responsibility to love our neighbor, right? And again, this is the central tension of international relations, is that sometimes loving your neighbor and hating your enemy seem to go hand in hand, right? But we can't, we cannot let that paradox dominate our thinking on this. We can't become, we can't say, well, Lord, these are your commands that I like, and these are the ones that are too inconvenient. And the, I think these are these conflicts where that becomes the hardest to square with each other. So when we look at the Russia-Ukraine conflict, we need to say, well, how can we best lead to the end of this death and suffering? When we look at the
But here's a question: are we looking for an end of death and suffering, or are we looking for a just outcome? Because the two may be different.
Well, I think the one thing that's unjust is to say, let's see how long we can make it go. Right. That's there are certain things that we can eliminate from the table.
Oh, right? Sure. Right. Right.
Yeah. And I guess that's more what I'm talking about. And when it comes to, there's limits on what we want to support when it comes to containing Iran, too. It's very tempting to look at the fall of Syria and fall of Assad and think, well, OK, you know, good outcome. Let's move on. But we don't know yet. Right. We don't know what kind of a regime is going to be put up there. It's hard to look at that outcome and, you know, not think, for example, about the Christian population of Syria, which is still a large Christian population there, and the not all outcomes that could come from that conflict are better for them than Assad was, right? Because, you know, being from a religious minority themselves, the Assad family was actually had some incentive to protect minority religious interests. There are certain groups in the coalition that just took over that if they end up in the driver's seat, it would be a lot worse for the spread of the gospel in Syria, for example. And then when it comes to China in general, I mean, we're looking at another one of those situations where the best outcomes for the United States are not always the best outcomes for the people involved. And we need to think very carefully about how much we as Christians can say, okay, well, let's roll the dice on nuclear conflict, right? Let's play with the fates of the countries caught in the middle, right? I mean, if you live in Japan right now, you know, the stakes of a U.S.-China conflict are a lot different than they are here, than if you live here in the United States. We need to be thinking about those types of questions as we consider these things, and I think that's where our mind should be going in with these things from a Christian perspective.
Okay, well, good. Well, thank you for all that. We typically say I'll yield back the balance of my time, but you know what? We're going to continue.
Yeah, we'll be right back.
Conversation. So, I believe we'll move for a recess, and without objection, so ordered. Thank you, Seth.
Thank you.